cemetery is said to be deep inside of Gaza's second largest city, Khan Yunis.
Israel has said that they're going to hunt down everybody who was involved in the October 7th massacre.
Plus, to prevent the Israel-Hamas conflict from expanding, the U.S. has announced sanctions against 13 people and firms alleged to be providing tens of millions of dollars to the Houthis in Yemen.
And we said from very, very early on, when the president ordered additional military capability, that we don't want to see any actor, state or non-state, widen or deepen and escalate this conflict.
Today is Friday, December 8th, and this is VOA's International Edition. Hello, I'm Rick Pantaleo in Washington. The Israeli military has fought its way deep into Gaza's second largest city, Khan Yunis, and has surrounded the home of a high-ranking Hamas leader who is believed to be hiding underground within a labyrinth of underground tunnels. I spoke with VOA Middle East correspondent Linda Gradstein in Jerusalem, who talked about these and other recent developments in the Israel-Hamas war.
Yes, so it's more of a symbol than anything else. Yahya Sinwar, by the way, the head of Hamas at the moment, was released in a former prisoner exchange. If you remember, there was an Israeli soldier, Gilad Shalit, who was captured in 2005. And in 2011, Israel freed more than 1,000, mostly Hamas prisoners, in exchange for the soldier. He was one of those freed, and then he became the leader of Hamas. And I think that Israel surrounding his house and destroying his house is kind of a trying to send a message to him that they will get to him. Israel has said that they're going to hunt down everybody who was involved in the October 7th massacre of 1,200, mostly civilians in Israel, and that none of them will escape alive, including in other countries. And Turkey has already said that if Israel does that, it will, you know, be very angry at Israel. I just wanted to add one more thing about the fighting, which is that the former chief of staff is somebody named Gadi Eisenkot. He's currently a Knesset member. He's a member of the war cabinet with Netanyahu. He's been talked about as a possible prime minister down the road. And today his son was killed fighting in Gaza.
Linda, you had mentioned this the other day, but I understand that Israel forces may indeed go ahead with flooding Hamas tunnels with seawater.
Yes, the idea is, in 2014, Israel and Hamas fought a sort of mini war, nothing like the current war. But Israeli soldiers went into the tunnels to try to fight Hamas, and a lot of Israeli soldiers were killed in the tunnels. So they decided that in this war, they don't want soldiers going into the tunnels. Now, there's been very heavy fighting of Hamas gunmen coming out of the tunnels and attacking Israeli soldiers, but they don't want to be in a situation where this Israeli soldiers go in, and then they're kind of sitting ducks for Hamas. So they put these seawater pumps, and they would pump seawater from Gaza and flood the tunnels. The problem, of course, is that there are still 138 hostages, Israeli hostages, being held by Hamas in these tunnels. And apparently they're being moved around a lot based on testimonies from hostages who were freed during the ceasefire. So if they flood a tunnel to kill the Hamas gunmen, they could conceivably kill the Israeli hostages as well.
Linda, I understand that the Israeli government has approved what is being called a minimal increase of supplies of fuel to Gaza to prevent a humanitarian collapse there.
UN officials were asked this very question. They say that they, as far as they know, Hamas is not taking the aid, any of the aid that's meant, and that it's their job to make sure that it gets to the people who need it. And Israel made this decision to increase the fuel after heavy pressure from the United States, that basically the United States said, you have to try to do more to prevent a humanitarian crisis. That said, I was on a webinar today with about 9 different representatives of humanitarian organizations in Gaza, and they say that the situation is really becoming untenable. Things like 1,000 kids waiting to use one toilet, the UN facilities are simply not able to handle the numbers of people that have actually fled northern Gaza, which is what Israel told them to do, and moved to the south, where they were supposed to be safe, and now the fighting is in the south.
That was VOA Middle East correspondent Linda Gradstein in Jerusalem. The U.S. has announced sanctions against 13 people and firms that allegedly are providing tens of millions of dollars to the Houthis in Yemen. The Iranian-backed Houthi rebels claim responsibility for recent attacks on ships on the Red Sea. National Security Council spokesperson John Kirby comments at a White House briefing Thursday.
It's a risk. It's clearly a risk to the potential widening and deepening of the conflict. And we said from very, very early on when the president ordered additional military capability that we don't want to see any actor, state or non-state, widen or deepen and escalate this conflict. And what the Houthis are doing could have that effect. Now, this goes to Jackie's question. Are we in a conflict with the Houthis? We're not in a conflict in the Houthis right now. We're not seeking a conflict with the Houthis. But what we are seeking is to be able to defend ourselves and to prevent this conflict from widening.
The sanctions accuse the individuals and entities of funneling foreign currency to the Houthis from the sale and shipment of Iranian commodities. The White House is also encouraging Mideast allies to join the Combined Maritime Forces, a partnership that exists to counter action by non-state actors in international waters. The Biden administration is running out of time to secure a deal on tens of billions of dollars in wartime aid for Ukraine and Israel that Senate Republicans blocked Wednesday. President Joe Biden has signaled that he is willing to compromise on Republicans' demands on border security to get the package through. But his aides accuse Republicans of ignoring Biden's proposal. White House Bureau Chief Patsy Witakaswara has this report.
Images released by the Ukrainian army shows the damage in the aftermath of a Russian attack in the southern city of Kherson this week, as U.S. funding for Kyiv's defense against Moscow's invasion is blocked by Senate Republicans who are demanding tougher measures to secure the U.S. border with Mexico. Republican Senator Jim Risch speaking to VOA.
We Republicans are very serious about closing our southern border. We have about over 10,000 people a day, illegals crossing into the United States. We need to defend our border first and foremost.
The White House says Republicans have ignored its border and immigration reform proposal. President Joe Biden warned on Wednesday that if Kyiv loses its war, Russian President Vladimir Putin will move beyond Ukraine to attack a NATO member, and the U.S. will be obligated to defend it.
Then we'll have something that we don't seek and that we don't have today. American troops fighting Russian troops. American troops fighting Russian troops if he moves into other parts of NATO.
Biden has signaled he is willing to compromise, but he says time is running out. There is $4.8 billion remaining in aid for Ukraine, but only $1.1 billion left to replenish U.S. weapons and equipment stockpiles to supply Kyiv what it needs. Emma Ashford, senior fellow with the Reimagining U.S. Grand Strategy Program at the Stimson Center via Skype.
If U.S. aid doesn't come through, Europeans are likely to step into the breach to some extent. But at a minimum, the Ukrainians are going to have to turn to a more defensive war and potentially start to look for ways to actually end the conflict.
VOA asked National Security Council's John Kirby whether the administration would support ceasefire negotiations.
President Zelensky gets to determine how and when this war ends and under what conditions he's willing to negotiate with Mr. Putin.
To pass $60 billion in aid for Ukraine and $10 billion for Israel, Congress has limited time before the end-of-year break. European partners are nervous. Britain will continue supporting Kyiv, Foreign Secretary David Cameron told VOA on Thursday.
But clearly, America is an essential partner in this. They are the world's biggest economy, the biggest defense player, absolutely vital.
Complicating matters, January 19th is also the first deadline to fund part of the government to prevent a shutdown. Patsy Witakaswara, VOA News.
Mexico City residents are regaining composure after the capital was rattled by a moderate magnitude earthquake. The U.S. Geological Survey said the quake occurred Thursday in a rural village located almost 200 kilometers south of Mexico City. Greece and Turkey made significant progress toward mending relations Thursday as leaders of the neighboring countries agreed to several cooperative measures after years of tension. And at least three-fourths of Africans can't afford a healthy diet, and a fifth are undernourished due to an unprecedented food crisis, United Nations agency said in a report Thursday with the African Union Commission. VOA's International Edition continues. I'm Rick Pantaleo. The White House on Thursday reiterated the United States' unwavering support for Guyana's sovereignty amid growing border tensions between Guyana and Venezuela. This is National Security Council spokesperson John Kirby.
We obviously support the peaceful resolution of the border dispute between Venezuela and Guyana. And we absolutely stand by our unwavering support for Guyana's sovereignty. The 1899 arbitral award that determined the land boundary between those two countries should be respected unless or until the parties themselves reach a new agreement or a competent legal body decides otherwise, and that hadn't happened. So we're going to urge Venezuela and Guyana to continue to seek a peaceful resolution of this dispute, including by the International Court of Justice.
The long-running dispute over an oil-rich region, which is heard by the International Court of Justice, escalated over the weekend when voters in Venezuela rejected the court's jurisdiction and backed creation of a new Venezuelan state. Guyana has questioned the vote's legitimacy and put its armed forces on high alert. The leaders of China and the European Union have held wide-ranging talks that include their disputes over trade and a deep divide over the war in Ukraine. Chinese President Xi Jinping met Thursday in Beijing with his European counterparts, Charles Michel and Ursula von der Leyen.
Politically, European leaders will not be able to tolerate that our industrial base is undermined by unfair competition. We like competition. It makes us better. It lowers prices. It's good for the consumers. But competition needs to be fair.
The EU is calling on China to improve market access to address an annual trade imbalance of more than $200 million between the two sides. China is unhappy with EU restrictions on technology exports and an EU investigation into subsidies for electric vehicles. The hours grow longer, and the already high sense of urgency somehow amps up even more as United Nations COP28 climate talks head into their final week. Every sentence, every word, especially those about the future elimination of fossil fuels, will matter at the UN conference in oil-built Dubai. In the packed pediatric emergency room of a Lahore public hospital, parents holding sick children lined up for treatment this week, part of a surge of young patients caused by the air pollution in Pakistan's second most populous city. Reuters' Rachel Graham has more.
In this packed pediatric emergency room in Pakistan's Lahore, children are struggling to breathe. Parents held nebulizing devices, engulfing their children's faces in a billow of steam, delivering medication to ease their congested airways. More lined up awaiting treatment. Toxic smog has been choking the 11 million residents of Pakistan's second most populous city for weeks, as a thick haze blocks the sun and shrouds streets with fog at night. The air pollution problem here becomes more severe in cooler months, as temperature inversion prevents a layer of warm air from rising and traps pollutants closer to the ground. Once known as a city of gardens, Lahore last year claimed the title of world's worst for air quality. Health officials estimate there has been a 50% rise in pediatric patients presenting with respiratory issues exacerbated by poor air quality in the last month. Dr. Maria Iftikhar has seen the problem spiraling.
If our OPD was, for instance, of 10,000 in the last month, from them, like around 6,000 to 7,000 a patient presented to us with a complaint of upper respiratory tract or lower respiratory tract infection.
The UN Children's Agency says globally, outdoor air pollution contributed to 154,000 deaths of children aged below 5 in 2019. In Pakistan, it is one of the top 5 causes of death among the entire population. Provincial Health Minister Dr. Javed Akram said hospitals were on high alert with beds and ventilators set aside for extra emergency cases.
Our pediatric hospitals, they are overwhelmed with burden from the respiratory issues. In any case, the most common cause of infant mortality, obviously we are struggling to have meet sustainable development goals here. The neonatal mortality is mainly driven from gastrointestinal disease and then respiratory disease. Yeah.
4 partial lockdowns have taken place since the start of November, as well as campaigns to promote masks in an effort to alleviate strain on health services. Officials point to crop burning as a major contributor to the toxic cloud. where farmers set light to fields to remove remnants of rice crops to make way for wheat, as well as poor quality fuel in vehicles, construction and industrial activity. Without costly investments in specialised equipment for farmers, burning could not be fully curbed without risking food security. The provincial government has reached out to authorities in India on how to improve the quality of air blowing across the border and consulted with experts in China.
That's Reuters' Rachel Graham. NASA celebrates a quarter century of human cooperation in space, plus a busy week of space launches, and America's Dad wants you to see the moon like those who've been there. VOA's Hirosh Irabasani brings us the week in space.
And liftoff of the 86 Progress resupply vehicle.
We begin this week on a launch pad at the Baikonur Cosmodrome in Kazakhstan. There, an uncrewed Russian Progress 86 cargo ship successfully launched on a resupply mission to the International Space Station. Progress 86 made its approach with the ISS 2 days later when it delivered nearly 3 tons of food, fuel, and supplies to the orbiting outpost. The delivery came just days before NASA celebrated the 25th anniversary of the International Space Station. Space Station Program Manager Joel Montalbano on a call with ISS Mission Commander Andreas Mogensen aboard the ISS as carried by NASA TV and provided by Reuters.
What was something that you couldn't be taught on Earth that you had to get in orbit and had to learn it by yourselves?
Well, weightlessness. You know, that is something that is truly unique up here. There is unfortunately no way to train weightlessness on Earth. We can get a taste of it on a parabolic flight, but it's just not the same as actually living and working in weightlessness up here. And it's not just fun, but it's also very challenging.
It was November 20, 1998, when Russia launched a Proton rocket carrying the Russian-built, U.S.-financed Zarya navigation module. Meaning dawn or sunrise, Zarya would bring together the U.S., Russia, Europe, Japan, and Canada in what's been called the most expensive home ever built. NASA Associate Administrator Bob Cabana in Houston speaking with flight engineer Laurel O'Hara aboard the ISS as carried by NASA TV and provided by Reuters.
How do you find life on ISS?
There are groups of people, teams of people all over the world who are figuring out every aspect of these missions, everything from our food and clothes to the science research that we'll be doing on board. They're also the ones who are operating space station. Believe it or not, even though we're on board, we don't actually fly space station. That's flown by the teams of flight controllers and mission control centers in Houston and Russia and elsewhere on the planet.
Meanwhile, in a video released by the Iranian Defense Ministry and which VOA cannot independently verify, Iran says it has sent a capsule carrying animals into orbit. The Islamic Republic also says it plans to launch human missions in coming years. Also this week, the South Korean Defense Ministry says it successfully placed a small Earth observation satellite into orbit. The launch was a part of South Korea's surveillance network against its neighbor to the north.
In the 50,000 years of human history, just 12 of us have traveled from our Earth to walk on another celestial body.
Finally this week, it is none other than the actor affectionately known as America's Dad, Tom Hanks, narrating and executive producing an immersive experience of the first moon landings from 1969 to 1972. All four walls of the London-based show are screens, bringing NASA's Apollo missions to life during the 50-minute film. Called The Moonwalkers, the show includes interviews with the crew of Artemis II scheduled for a lunar flyby late next year. Hirosh Irabasani, VOA News.
A new optical ground station has been built by the Australian National University to help the U.S. Space Agency, NASA, and others explore space and safely reach Mars. From Sydney, Phil Mercer reports.
The Australian team has developed a new type of space communication using lasers. Researchers say the system will allow them to connect with satellites and NASA crewed missions beyond low Earth orbit. The project is supported by the Australian Space Agency's Moon to Mars initiative. The Australian National University Quantum Optical Ground Station is based at the Mount Stromlo Observatory near Canberra. It's a powerful telescope that will support high-speed advanced communications with satellites orbiting at distances from low Earth orbit to the Moon. Kate Ferguson, Associate Director for Strategic Projects at the Australian National University Institute for Space, told VOA current communication systems relying on radio frequencies can be slow and cumbersome.
I'm sure some of us remember the grainy pictures that we got of the moon landing that came from the Apollo era. So again, the current radio frequency systems, they have these much slower data rates, and especially over really long distances for space exploration, those become very slow. But with optical communications, we'll be able to increase the rate of that communication.
She said the new system, based on powerful lasers that are invisible to the naked eye, will transform communications in space.
What we're aiming to do is to be able to receive high-definition video from future crewed missions. Not only will that be great for us here on Earth, seeing what's happening with the astronauts on these types of missions, but it will improve the connectivity between those missions. And what we're doing here is optical communications, which uses laser beams to communicate. And these offer much higher speeds and increased security over the current systems. And this is really important for us for getting that data down and being able to use it here on Earth.
Scientists say the Australian-developed systems will be compatible with NASA missions. They say the laser-based technology will improve astronauts' ability to connect with Earth from the moon and also allow high-definition video to be sent from the moon and Mars. NASA has said previously that astronauts could be sent on a mission to the Red Planet by the mid to late 2030s. Phil Mercer, VOA News, Sydney.
This has been International Edition on the Voice of America. On behalf of everyone at VOA, thank you for joining us. For pictures, stories, videos, and more, follow VOA News on your favorite social media platform and online at voanews.com. Until next time, this is Rick Pantaleo in Washington, wishing you good day, good health, and good news tomorrow.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
The United States will respond to the malign activities of Iran-backed forces. On December 3rd, three commercial vessels traveling in the southern Red Sea put out distress calls. The U.S. Navy destroyer Carney responded to the distress calls from these ships and provided assistance, said U.S. National Security Advisor Jake Sullivan.
In doing so, it detected three UAVs at three different times heading in its direction. And it took action against all three of those UAVs. We have every reason to believe that these attacks, while they were launched by the Houthis in Yemen, were fully enabled by Iran.
The December 3rd attacks in the waters of the Red Sea by the Iran-backed Houthis are not isolated incidents. In a statement, U.S. Central Command said such attacks represent a direct threat to international commerce and maritime security. They have jeopardized the lives of international crews representing multiple countries around the world. National Security Advisor Sullivan noted the position of the United States consistent with the U.N. Security Council and consistent with the position of maritime nations across the world is that attacks on commercial shipping in international waters are totally unacceptable and have to stop. He added, this is not just an issue for the United States.
We are in talks with other countries about maritime task force of sorts involving the ships from partner nations alongside the United States in ensuring safe passage of ships in the Red Sea.
In a separate incident on December 3rd, the United States preempted an imminent attack on U.S. forces by Iran-backed militants near Kirkuk. U.S. forces responded in self-defense with an armed drone, which killed five militants. U.S. forces are in Iraq and Syria as part of the coalition to defeat ISIS. They have been subject to dozens of attacks by Iran-backed militants in recent weeks. The U.S. has responded by repeatedly striking facilities in Iraq and Syria used by Iran's IRGC and associated militias. As we are working to stabilize the region, Iran is raising tensions, said U.S. Secretary of Defense Lloyd Austin. These attacks must stop, and until they do, we will do what we need to do to protect our troops and to impose costs on those who attack them.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.